They want to give Netanyahu whatever he wants. Here is Pete Hegseth on the show that he hosted, which, footnote, I once hosted a long time ago, called Fox and Friends. At the very end of this clip, which is a little under a minute, he calls for bombing cultural sites in Tehran. Chris, cut number 12.
Sometimes you have moments, Steve, and I happen to believe that we can't kick the can down the road any longer in trying to prevent Iran from getting a nuclear bomb. They used the killing of Soleimani as an excuse to say, we're scrapping the Iran deal. We all know they were scrapping it anyway. So what better time than now to say, we're starting the clock. You've got a week. You've got X amount of time before we start taking out your energy production facilities. We take out key infrastructure. We take out your missile sites. We take out nuclear developments.
That is
we
not
take out
a popular
port
idea.
Capabilities. Or, you know what, take out a Quds headquarters while you're at it, if you want. I understand that's not a popular idea. If we're going to fight to prevent Iran from getting a nuclear bomb, this regime, then we need to rewrite the rules that are advantageous to us. I don't want to hit cultural sites on purpose, but if you're using one to harbor your most dangerous weapons, then that should be on the target list.
Rewrite the rules so they favor us. Gee, I wonder what Vladimir Putin would do if the United States purported to bomb Tehran, Secretary Hegseth. What do you think, Phil?
Well, I think Vladimir Putin would actually act in terms of his own national interests and might feel that that is a non-productive direction to be going in. I would point out that this Hegseth is crazier even than he just came across as. I've been informed by a good friend who's followed his career rather closely that he's not only in a rather extremist Christian in many respects. He's also what was referred to as a third temple person. Now, these are the Christians who basically want to destroy the Muslim Al-Aqsa Mosque in Jerusalem and replace it with a third Jewish temple. And this, of course, would, in their minds, would lead to the Armageddon. That would lead to the end of the world, and we would all either go up to heaven or somewhere else. So this is how crazy these people are. And to be talking about these people as potential secretaries of defense with all those weapons and all those tools at their fingertips, this is obscene. This is so bad. You know, who could imagine that a guy like this would be considered for Secretary of Defense?
This is Pete Hegseth talking about women in combat. Number 13, Chris.
I think a huge one is women in combat and quotas. I think the way they pushed that under Obama in a way that had nothing, zero to do with efficacy, zero to do with lethality and capability.
You don't like women in combat?
No.
Why not?
I love women service members who contribute amazingly because everything about men and women serving together makes the situation more complicated, and complication in combat means casualties are worse.
Is there a basis for that, or is this just his cultural conservatism?
Well, I think there's a certain basis for it, in that women, obviously, in certain combat roles have certain physical liabilities like upper body strength and things like that. But to make an across-the-board condemnation of this, I think the experiment of women in many Department of Defense roles has been very positive.
What do you think is the big picture here with Donald Trump appointing these neocons, warmongers and Zionists to these sensitive positions? I don't know if the Rubio thing is going to happen or not, but Stefanik, Huckabee, and Hegseth have formally been announced. What do you think is Trump's game here? Did he materially mislead the American public during the campaign? Did we misread him? Is there something going on here that we don't know about? Is he a secret neocon who really likes war because he likes to kill people like he killed General Soleimani, who was on a peace mission?
Well, he certainly believes he has the license to kill, just as Mr. Netanyahu does. And that's a very dangerous thing. The president does not have a license to kill. But, you know, this is all scary stuff. You know what really scares me is the fact that we are enabling someone who is plausibly insane in the form of Netanyahu to do whatever he needs to get away with his own personal needs and also for the advancement of Israel as the sole major military power in the Mideast region. And I am very afraid that this clown, this idiot, would use nuclear weapons if he felt it was a good idea on Iran, on Syria, on Lebanon. And we'd get people like these gentlemen that we're just talking about who would endorse it, would say, oh, it's perfectly all right. They were being threatened by an Iran that has the capability of building its own nuclear weapons. We would hear that kind of thing. And that's when my head explodes.
Who will have the upper hand, Trump or Netanyahu? Or stated differently, is there a reason for Netanyahu's bounce in his step? Does he now believe he'll get whatever he wants from the U.S. government under Donald Trump?
Well, he obviously believes that because people are telling him that. And I would suspect that those are the people in the Israel lobby in the United States, and as well as that people like Miriam Eggleston, who gave him $100 million to basically allow her country, Israel, to take over all of historic Palestine. So we have all these kind of influences working on Trump, who admittedly is not a very well-educated or bright man. He's driven by ego. He's driven by compulsions. And this makes him happy to think that he's so loved by all these sorts of people.
He once proclaimed himself, I think you wrote about this in your column at the UNS Review, and this might actually be true, that he's the most popular politician in Israel.
Yeah, he said he could get elected to high office in Israel instantly because he's so popular.
I guess he forgot that he's not Jewish and therefore he's not not eligible for the office.
Well, I did say he's not intelligent.
Thank you, Phil. Always a pleasure. I appreciate you moving your usual time to accommodate my needs. No matter what we talk about, it's a pleasure to hear you and be able to pick your brain. All the best, my dear friend.
Okay, well, have a good debate today.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
Your option, our task. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. The Limelight.
As the fabricated regime of Israel is a product of Britain's imperial machinations, those British politicians who enable its crimes are following a historical pattern. It is a pattern soaked with the blood of Palestinians. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Please stay tuned for more. Electronic Intifada wrote, committing a genocide is clearly not enough for a large bloc within the Zionist regime's ruling coalition. The far-right ministers in the government, backed by some members of Benjamin Netanyahu's Likud party, are intensifying their push for recolonizing Gaza. Their goal of building new settlements in a territory subjected to wholesale destruction is equally despicable and logical. It is in keeping with the logic of the Balfour Declaration. The November 1917 document, which kickstarted a process whereby a Jewish regime would be established in Palestine. The anniversary of the declaration is an occasion to reflect on thinking behind it, as well as its consequences. Arthur James Balfour, Britain's foreign secretary at the time, was under no illusions about what he was doing in issuing that pledge of support for the Zionist movement. His declaration did not specify the contours of the regime being envisaged, which was euphemistically described as a national home. Yet, it did prove vital for creating facts on the ground to use more recent Zionist parlance. That is precisely what Balfour intended. In 1919, Balfour wrote a letter to David Lloyd George, then Prime Minister, after an Anglican bishop in Al-Quds had queried British policy towards Zionism. Balfour admitted that there was a weak point in Britain's position as it deliberately and rightly declined to accept the principle of self-determination for Palestine. That would mean asking Palestine's indigenous people, whom Balfour called its present inhabitants, for their views. Balfour wrote, if the present inhabitants were consulted, they would unquestionably give an anti-Jewish verdict, adding that we conceive the Jews to have a historic claim to have a home in their ancient land, provided that home can be given them without either dispossessing or oppressing the present inhabitants. It is important to parse Balfour's choice of words. Before the Balfour Declaration, Muslims, Christians and Jews lived in Palestine without major hostility and frequently on friendly and harmonious terms. The anti-Jewish verdict that Balfour wished to avoid would not be directed at Jews because of their ethnicity or religion. It would rather be a verdict against a colonization project which would deny basic rights to Palestinians despite how Britain contended otherwise. The Balfour Declaration was later enshrined in the League of Nations mandate under which Britain would rule Palestine following the First World War. Winston Churchill championed the declaration repeatedly. Churchill stated in 1921 that the declaration must be regarded as one of the facts definitely established by the triumphant conclusion of the Great War. Churchill was an avid supporter of Zionism. Blake Alcott's The Rape of Palestine demonstrates just how avid a supporter Churchill was. In one 1937 discussion on the Balfour Declaration, Churchill spoke about the good faith of England to the Jews, adding, "We are bound by honour, and I think upon the merits to push this thing as far as we can." Pushing this thing, the colonisation of Palestine, as far as we can, required crushing resistance to the Zionist project. During the same 1937 discussion, Churchill sought to justify Britain's approach by saying, "We have every right to strike hard in support of our authority." Churchill personally authorized brutal repression. As colonial secretary in 1921, he was instrumental in sending a specialized police force to Palestine. It was comprised of men who had previously served in Ireland with the British forces known as the Black and Tans and the Auxiliaries. To this day, the black and tans are synonymous with immense cruelty during Ireland's War of Independence. The black and tans set fire to entire neighborhoods of Cork City and Bargian, the hometown in North County, Dublin. As Caroline Elkins writes in her book Legacy of Violence, Palestine came to replace Ireland as the official and unofficial training ground for colonial police indoctrination. By 1943, 5 out of Palestine's 8 district police commissioners had previously served with the Black and Tans in Ireland. Just recently, David Lammy, Britain's foreign secretary, suggested that the seriousness of the term genocide is undermined if it is applied to Israel's current war against Gaza. It is understandable that a senior British politician would try to excuse or downplay the Zionist regime's crimes. The Zionist regime is, after all, seeking to perfect crimes which it learned from Britain. When Britain ran Palestine, it set up a concentration camp and resorted to home demolitions, collective punishment, and imprisonment without charge or trial. Douglas Duff, one of the former Black and Tan members who went on to become a police chief in Palestine, wrote about the torture techniques which he used and possibly pioneered. His memoirs indicate that he introduced the practice now called waterboarding to Palestine. The Zionist regime has kept up the tradition he established. Palestinians kidnapped by the Zionist regime troops now occupying Gaza have undergone waterboarding. Testimony gathered by the United Nations Human Rights Office has found. Arthur James Balfour once expressed the desire to see the strengthening and consolidation of the British Empire. The Balfour Declaration reflected such thinking. It was hoped that the Zionists would form for England a little loyal Jewish Ulster in a sea of potentially hostile Arabism. According to Ronald Storrs, Al-Quds-based military administrator. The irony is that Britain's sponsorship of Zionism helped to weaken the empire. As the Zionist movement felt that colonization was not advancing with sufficient speed, it fell out with Britain in 1940s. Some elements in the movement even conducted bombing and assassination campaigns against the British. Concluding that Palestine was unmanageable, the British eventually had to leave that land with their tails between their legs. The British departed Palestine as Zionist forces they had trained were implementing the Nakba, the mass expulsion of Palestinians from their homes. Although the empire has shrunk, many figures in the British establishment still have an imperial mindset. As the fabricated regime of Israel is a product of Britain's imperial machinations, those British politicians who enable its crimes are following a historical pattern. It is a pattern soaked with the blood of Palestinians.
Hidden files. Hello and welcome to Hidden Files. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, we're very fortunate today to have a very special guest with me here in the studio, Mr. Gilles Duvert from France, international lawyer and very, very influential in what he's doing, especially dealing with the Palestinian situation. So stay with us. We have a very good show for you.
Gilles Duvert is a lawyer, former hospital nurse, and a lecturer and researcher at the Faculty of Law of the University of Lyon 3. For some 30 years, he has been active in health and social sectors and the defense of minorities in France, Palestine, and elsewhere. He's filed a complaint with the International Court of Justice on behalf of groups representing victims of Israeli attacks during the 2008-2009 Gaza War.
Very happy to have you here with me. Can you please tell me about yourself and why did you decide to take the lead at the International Criminal Court to prosecute Israel?
First of all, I would like to tell you the pleasure is all mine, and I'm happy to be here in Tehran, in Iran. And we have been working for a week together with my lawyer friends. And although we may have a lot of differences, we find ourselves on common ground when it comes to the issue of the legal rights of the Palestinians, which is very, very heartwarming and very important. And then there's also the personal aspect of it, if you will, that one does not become a lawyer representing the Palestinian people by chance. An important choice was made by the lawyer, and initially it is a reflection on human rights, on what we know as and what we call human rights. However, almost always the spotlight is on the individual, and that leads to missing the essential issue here, which is the collective aspect of it. So the first step is to highlight and to have a collective defense in order to defend the people in court. So I've worked a lot on this issue, and this time I'm doing it for Palestinians. You should know that I have also done this for other cases. For example, I'm particularly involved in the case of the Western Sahara. I currently represent the Polisario Front, which is a small group of Sahrawi people who are fighting for their independence. Also in France, there are issues pertaining to the colonial era that have not been resolved properly in Guadeloupe, in Mayotte, and in New Caledonia. And there's also the situation of minorities in France. In short, defending people's collective rights is my area of expertise and what interests me the most.
But particularly this case and prosecuting Israel, let's start from here. Are you optimistic because it's never been done before?
I'm an optimist, but not an ordinary optimist who says, oh, the world is so wonderful. On the contrary, I would say that the world is an extremely difficult place to live in. It's incredibly harsh for the Palestinians in particular. So I am optimistic because I can see that today we can reap the rewards of 15 years of legal work on the Palestine issue. And this is the legal work that has been done directly for the Palestinians, and especially the Palestinians in Gaza, those who were easier to contact. So that is how we were able to build many legal cases. And when I see the difficulties we had at the beginning, I have to acknowledge that there were many, many obstacles we had to overcome. The obstacles were lifted little by little. I will elaborate on that later. But when I filed the complaint on November 9th, considering that I had contacted the prosecutor's office maybe 10 in advance, I got an appointment right away. Maybe 10 months in advance, I got an appointment right away. I was able to arrange a meeting at the victim's support office. I was also able to arrange a meeting at the prosecutor's office, and we immediately started working on the substantive questions regarding the case and on the evidence. Because all the accountability issues that you find in the media reports all the time, all of that has been resolved between us. So here we have the Palestinian people and the lawyers. The lawyers make appointments with the prosecutor. We are received, and the investigation begins. All of this leads you to conclude that there is a level of optimism because we have made progress. That's the first thing. And the second is that lawyers are beginning to understand that they have work to do. Not too long ago, everything related to Palestine was managed by NGOs. And without a doubt, NGOs can do great things on a social level and when it comes to delivering aid and also on a communication level. But with all due respect, they're not legal professionals. Everyone should be doing their own job. When you're sick, you go see a doctor. You don't go to a journalist who has written a book on the disease. So when you have a legal problem, go see a lawyer. Trust me, you will be treated very well. So here's what happens. Lawyers know how to carry out legal procedures. It's their job. Things are changing gradually. I initiated it, and now we're spending a lot of time raising awareness on this issue. So when we launched the project, in fact, in only 1 week, we had over 300 signatures. And now we're very satisfied because we've been able to gather around the Palestinian Bar Association and create the largest solidarity movement between lawyers that has ever existed in history. All of this leads you to say that it is not just a symbolic move. It is law working at its best.
Yeah, it's very interesting. Why hasn't this done before? Why hasn't this been done before? Because we know that the situation with the Palestinians has been going on for 75 years now. So why haven't we seen legal measures taken before in the international community?
I think even the situation in Palestine and the way it's been for the past 57 years has been defined by international law as being under military occupation. However, I personally prefer to base my own analysis on the events that have happened since 1917 and the Balfour Declaration. And the complaint that I filed for the genocide case also reviews the events from 1917. Because in 1917, they said that we were going to create a Jewish national home in Palestine. However, in Palestine, the mayor of Jerusalem can immediately react by saying, but you cannot create a state here because we're already here, we exist. And so, in fact, you have a continuous chain of events from 1917 until now. And indeed, as far as the Palestinians are concerned, the historical background is very important. You may ask why? That is because the Palestinians are not in a position to claim anything in legal terms. If employees ask for something, they claim it. If people want more freedom, they claim it. But Palestinians are not claiming anything. They're simply saying, we have rights that must be respected. We have the right to live on our land. We are the Palestinian people. There is a Palestinian land. I'm not claiming it, but instead I'm simply asking for my rights to be respected. Well, for a very long time, there were no legal actions, but now there are two things I have to point out. First, from the 1970s, there was the Great Palestinian Movement based on armed resistance, which combined resistance and legal discourse. And this was very effective because the Palestinian people, who were completely eliminated from the UN, returned to the UN while their right to sovereignty and their right to self-determination was also recognized. And the Palestinian National Authority was recognized as a sovereign movement representing the people. So that was great progress, but the law had been used as an argument to put forth links with the resistance. And just as we reach this result, there is obviously the United States, which, as we know, is always there to stop the movement in order to protect Israel, who is there to control this part of the Middle East and divide the territory. So they saw the catastrophe coming, and the catastrophe was the fact that after all the mess that was created, Palestine was going to become a state. It was going to be recognized again as a state. And so they put pressure on them to negotiate for peace, pushing for the Oslo Accords to be signed. I spare you the details. What eventually happened was that they said, okay, so you're here for peace, therefore you have to negotiate, of course. So then you begin to negotiate within the framework of the Oslo Accords. And that is how they managed to sell this to the Palestinians. The Oslo Accords were a very big regression. Why? Because the people who had managed to become the subject of international law lost this position. and they became dependent on the Israeli side, as if it was the Israeli side that had all the rights and could transfer it to them. This is how the Palestinian Authority was created, and how it was detached from international law, and therefore was not likely to go to court. Because if they ever said, "We're acting on behalf of the Palestinian Authority from a legal aspect," the response would be, "Well, the Palestinian Authority gets its existence from the Oslo Accords, so you can't invoke a treaty. You cannot take your case to court." So first, this process has to be eliminated with everything the Palestinians believe in, considering the fact that the Oslo Accords were simply encouraging colonization. And now, the most important thing for me about the recent developments is to see Palestinians pulling out of the Oslo Accords. In other words, to see the end of the Oslo Accords. And finally, for this to be the excellent news, the Palestinian people are once again recognized by international law. They can sign treaties, they can be represented in court, and they can find sister states like South Africa, for example, who will do what it did to start a legal procedure, which creates the opportunity for them to appear before the judges and to hire lawyers to defend them. The Oslo Accords were a legal disaster, and we're coming out of it with the return of Palestinian people in the sphere of international law. Now, the second point I would like to raise very quickly is that these international proceedings, as we will see very soon, are too complicated. They're not very satisfactory. A lot of things about them will have to change. But the important issue is that they exist. So we're seeking to improve them, to strengthen them, like a child that is growing up, rather than repeating what propaganda wants us to, that we should eliminate them altogether because they're no good, simply because they want a world without justice. But everyone can draw parallels with what happened in Sabra and Shatila. Sabra and Shatila was a massacre. Maybe not a genocide, because the scale of the victims was not that much, but it was a massacre. And it was, at the very least, a crime against humanity. However, there were no legal proceedings. Why? Because there were no international courts. Now we have the courts. We can improve them. We can demand judges be more available. That is the truth. There are courts that exist, and the people of Palestine now have the benefit of having access to an international court, say the ICC. They can hire lawyers to represent them in court, and they can also give us mandates. You, as a Palestinian, give me a mandate, you sign it, and the next day I see a prosecutor and I say, "I'm here to defend a Palestinian."
Can you explain the difference between the International Court of Justice, ICC, and the International Criminal Court, ICC?
You're absolutely right, because there can be confusion. It's not all very simple. The oldest international court is the ICJ, which stands for the International Court of Justice. It dates back to the establishment of the UN in 1945, and it is the UN-based international court. So it has authority over all the states that are registered in the UN General Assembly. But this court has jurisdiction only over the states. That is to say, for example, we have criticized the court for not ruling to demand a ceasefire with the war against Hamas, which is in fact one of the two parties. But the truth is, it could not have demanded a ceasefire because the armed resistance is not a state. This court, the ICJ, can only address states. However, it is the most important of all international courts. And when we look at the rulings, very often we see that the party that has lost says, "But this ruling is political." But then, afterwards, they abide by the ruling because they cannot do otherwise. And the best example is the case of Nicaragua against the United States, where we have the small communist state of Nicaragua against a very powerful U.S. that rules the world. But Nicaragua had strong arguments. It presented them to the court, and the judge condemned the United States. And when the ruling was announced to the U.S., they said, "There must be a mistake. The judge doesn't understand anything." And then finally, a few months later, they abided by the court ruling because a state cannot retain its international status by saying, "I don't care what the International Court of Justice says." You see, that is impossible. because it is the court of the UN. So in the end, you simply have to abide by its ruling. And if the Israeli side does what it wants, like a criminal on the run, that's when its allies start to say, no, you can't keep on doing this. We're witnessing this happening right now. The ICC, however, is different. First of all, it is much more recent, dates back to 2002, so the court is actually only 20 years of history and experience. Now, this court accepts cases against people, not against states. So I filed a complaint and I requested an arrest warrant for Mr. Netanyahu, for the Israeli Minister of Defense, and for the Israeli head of state. I did not file a complaint against which and which state. So the ICC is a criminal court for people. So in fact, for example, if you commit a crime and you stand trial before the court and the prosecutor, you just might end up in prison. So not all the states recognize the ICC. Its recognition is voluntary. However, for the International Court of Justice, as long as you are a member of the UN, you are automatically under the control of the International Court of Justice. This is not the case with the ICC. Recognizing the ICC is voluntary because it's independent from the UN. Currently, there are 125 states that have accepted its jurisdiction, including the state of Palestine. And according to the rules and regulations, the court has jurisdiction from the moment that an element of a crime or a part of a crime is committed on the territory. So considering the fact that the state of Palestine has ratified the treaty and recognizes the court, the crimes committed on this territory fall under the jurisdiction of the court, no matter who commits the crime. The court does not care whether or not the defendant comes from a country that recognizes it, and the defendant can be arrested anywhere in the world.
Do you think that these courts, because of course there are people right now that are thinking that these courts have been politicized, that there are political elements that help control it. Do you think that, for example, if we're talking about the ICJ or the ICC, that there can be a fair hearing in looking at, for example, the Israeli regime?
I am in a place where I can confirm that the U.S. has a lot of influence in these international courts, particularly from the so-called Western clan. Because for the past 15 years, for example, I have seen all the obstacles put on my way. So I've lived the experience. But I can also see that despite all that, we are making progress. And so I must send this message once again, that I am not a happy-go-lucky optimist. This is an optimism that comes from achieving results. You should see the huge difference. When you are debating a case at the UN Security Council, say with Algeria's initiative, demanding a simple thing, as simple as a humanitarian ceasefire, something that's been discussed for a week prior to that through diplomatic means, you come to the actual session and Algeria presents its proposal for a humanitarian ceasefire and allowing humanitarian trucks to cross the border and bring food and medical supplies, the U.S. vetoes, and it's over. This is the reality of the political world we live in today. But when we go down the legal route, there is no veto from the United States. When the U.S. appears in the International Court of Justice, it has half an hour to make its case, just like Cuba. It has half an hour just like Comoros. It has half an hour just like Palestine. And there is no veto. And when we are at the International Court of Justice, they do have influence in the corridors. They have enough influence to try and pressure us. But they do not have direct influence in court, and so we continue. So I call for working on the legal aspect of the matter. Of course, there is a lot of work to be done because it is complicated. They create lots of obstacles for us. But we manage to make progress despite all that, and in the end, what do we see? We see that the judges are now actively involved. You know, the judges are required to have the same approach in applying the rules no matter where they are in the world. Let me explain. We are all well aware of this fundamental problem that exists, which we call double standards. The fact that I cry when something happens to someone and neglect it when it happens to someone else. Or, for example, I get really angry when someone does something and then approve of it when someone else does the same thing. We're all very familiar with this situation. But for a judge, this is impossible. And so, as more and more cases are referred to the court, the judge cannot rule differently. For example, because it is the case of Palestine, or it is the case of Libya or Crimea. As a judge, I'm required to adhere to the same ruling in similar cases. This is what makes it interesting. Whenever we file a complaint with the ICC or the ICJ, what we do as lawyers is to study the history of the court. By that, I mean they study similar cases that have been closed. We base our arguments on those cases by referring the court to its own previous rulings. So, for example, we can tell them in such and such case, this is what you ruled. So for the case of Palestine, you have to do the same. So for example, for the definition of genocide, we found 14 rulings from different international courts clarifying what it is. So since it has been seen defined by the court, we can build our case based on that. This is why our arguments are so strong.
We see the recent case filed, or petition filed in the International Court of Justice by South Africa. Let's talk about that. What exactly has happened with that? And tell me your perspective of how significant this is, the filing by South Africa.
Well, we should agree that this is a work in progress. The first step was the complaint that we filed as lawyers on November 9th. And as lawyers, we know what we can do in court. And we also know that they might limit what we can do because we do not represent a state and we're not political leaders. That is why we immediately sought to amplify our legal action by saying, we have shown you the way, but there are things which is up to the states to do. Lawyers clearly do not dominate the world. I would be an ordinary romantic with a suggestive view of reality if I were to think otherwise. On the contrary, I'm very, very pragmatic, and I know that we can raise a legal debate, but the states are definitely stronger than us. So we did all the work and even made it public, and then South Africa stepped in twice on two different occasions. Once at the beginning of December, South Africa filed a complaint with the International Criminal Court, the ICC. And South Africa did this with four other states that I want to mention because they are great supporters. There is Bangladesh, there is Djibouti, there is the Comoros, and there is Bolivia, all led by South Africa. So this matters because at the beginning, there was just a complaint made by lawyers on behalf of activist associations. And now there are five states also on board. At the same time, this shows the political weakness on the side of Palestine in terms of the number of states that supported because there are 125 states that recognize the ICC and there are only five who support the procedure. So if you think that the prosecutors could do more, you're right. But member states of the court also could do more. Because many of them say that they support Palestine, but when it comes to actions, well, there's nothing. In the meantime, it is clear that our legal procedure is supported by five states. If this increases to six or seven, we will be even more grateful. But for the time being, this is not the case. Then South Africa took the legal proceedings to the next level by citing the Genocide Convention. This is a convention on the prevention and suppression of genocide. First of all, the prevention part is interesting because there is a genocide taking place and this means that there are things we can do about it. And the second interesting thing is that Israel has ratified very few treaties, given that it doesn't want to get its hands tight, just like the United States. However, they have ratified the Geneva Convention and they have accepted the jurisdiction of the court. So, there was a text and there was a jurisdiction. And that's very rare because in many other cases, they have not ratified international treaties and we can't pursue the matter in court. So South Africa made a clever move by saying that they were going to use the Genocide Prevention Convention
considering the fact that the Israeli side has accepted the jurisdiction of the court to conduct such proceedings. So now we have a legal procedure on the basis of a convention which has not clearly defined what genocide is, and its interpretation will take a lot of time. In fact, the convention is quite brief, and there is a need to define genocide, and the states do not share a single opinion regarding that. But we have not reached a point where that would matter just yet. At the moment, we are in the urgent phase of taking preventive measures. So if you're a judge, say for example, a judge in Tehran, and we tell you that there is a building that might collapse, you may not know if it's going to collapse, but you will definitely take urgent action and demand people evacuate the building, because you have to protect them. You will later decide what should be done about the building. So it's the same thing here, and that is the challenging part. But given that there's still a high probability that a genocide is happening, we need to take measures to protect the people accordingly. There is the mechanics of the legal procedures and how it works. And the court reacted very well to this approach by South Africa, given that South Africa filed its request on December 29th. The hearing was scheduled on January 11th, and after much deliberation, the ruling was issued on January 26th. It didn't even take a month. 4 weeks was enough to file the complaint, schedule the hearing, and issue a ruling, which, by the way, came in 30 pages in French and English and was enforceable. So the court acted very well with regards to this procedure. What are they saying exactly? Well, the court tells all states, of course, by addressing Israel first and then all the states in the world, since it pertains to the UN, pay attention. There is a genocide going on, and necessary measures must be taken to protect the population. So the measures are aimed first at the Israeli side, that's for sure, but it also addresses all UN member states, and in particular, the supporters and allies of Israel by saying, you have to stop this now, otherwise you are going to move into the genocide camp. Ever since the following day are saying, well, yes, or I don't think so, etc. Yesterday, again in France, a political leader said, I don't think so. But who is this person? Can he replace the judges? No. He's just an insignificant politician, that's all. So the court said there is a genocide. We must protect the people. And the states now have to distance themselves from this crime. Their statements were weak. They wanted to show that they were not giving up. But we do know that suddenly they are asking Israel to act differently. And now that the deadlines are moving forward, they will begin to realize that they are going to be prosecuted for complicity. And this is exactly what Nicaragua has just done. Nicaragua acted just like South Africa with respect to Israel and also Germany, because Germany is the second largest provider of weapons to Israel. Germany has accepted the jurisdiction of the International Court of Justice. So there is an excellent case now filed by Nicaragua. Now, Germany risks being prosecuted for being complicit in the genocide. So we can see that these days, German leaders are saying, no, but we abide by the standards. We're no longer going to export this and that. So the legal proceedings are working.
Well, Mr. Gilles Dauvert, thank you so much. It has been a pleasure having you on Hidden Files, and all our best with what you're trying to do.
Thank you. Merci beaucoup.
And thank you for staying with us on another Hidden Files. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Goodbye.
Your option for today and a better tomorrow. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. In the Limelight.
The Commission of Detainees Affairs and the Palestinian Prisoners Society revealed degrading and shocking conditions under which Palestinian detainees from Gaza are facing in the Zionist regime's notorious Ofer prison. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Please stay tuned for more. Palestine Chronicle wrote, a report by two Palestinian rights organizations published recently comes following recent visits by their legal team to nine detainees from the Gaza Strip. The report outlined the systematic torture to which these detainees are subjected, which was described as theft and deprivation of detainees' rights. The report established, based on the testimonies of the detainees, that all previous reports by human rights organizations fall short to reflect the level of brutality that has been and is being practiced against Gaza's detainees. According to the report, one of the psychological torture methods aiming to humiliate Palestinian detainees is forcing them to chant to a so-called captain, "Thank you, Captain," in Hebrew. Those who refuse to comply are reportedly severely punished. The detainees spoke at length to the lawyers about the humiliating and degrading positions they are forced to endure. One of the examples of these humiliating positions is being forced to sit on their knees or stomachs in the camp yard for long hours during court sessions held over the phone. In terms of medical treatments, Palestinian detainees told the lawyers of the Palestinian organizations that the prison's administration continues to deprive them of medical attention. Some of the detainees who were allowed to speak to the legal team were suffering from wounds and injuries that had not healed as a result of their systematic deprivation of treatment. The two Palestinian rights groups voiced in their report their deep concern over the spread of skin diseases among the detainees from Gaza in view of the occupation authorities' ongoing policy of depriving them of hygiene products. The reports indicated the detainees have been forced to shower without soap for several months, and through follow-up, the lack of personal hygiene tools was the main reason for the spread of skin diseases among the prisoners and the detainees in various prisons. The Palestinian detainees also mentioned suffering from cold, especially at night, due to being deprived by Israeli occupation authorities of adequate clothing and covers. The report read, as is the case for thousands of prisoners and detainees in the Israeli prisons and camps, the occupation, as part of its systematic policies, is to transform cold weather conditions into a tool for abusing and torturing detainees. The report of the two organizations pointed out that a revenge spirit reigns amongst Israeli occupation troops and prison guards, competing who can be more brutal towards the Palestinian detainees. The report went on to highlight the main challenges that face the rights organizations in addressing the topic of the detainees from Gaza, especially in relation to the issue of the enforced disappearance of hundreds of detainees in Gaza. The two organizations stated that some of these challenges include ignoring the precise number of detainees from Gaza in Israeli occupation prisons and the unprecedented level of brutality, which include but are not limited to the crimes of torture, abuse, and the crime of starvation, in addition to systematic medical crimes, sexual assaults, and their use as human shields. One of the other obstacles that the report mentioned is that the Israeli Occupation Authority continues to prevent the International Committee of the Red Cross from visiting all prisoners and detainees. The Commission of Detainees Affairs and the Palestinian Prisoners Society revealed at the end of the report the names of some of the detainees at Ofer Prison based on accounts of prisoners with whom they were unable to speak. Of the 45 Palestinian prisoners mentioned in the report, 5 are children. Flouting a UN Security Council resolution demanding an immediate ceasefire, the fabricated regime of Israel has faced international condemnation amid its continued brutal offensive on the Gaza Strip. Currently on trial before the International Court of Justice for Genocide Against Palestinians, the child killer regime of Israel has been waging a devastating war on Gaza since October 7, 2023. According to Gaza's Ministry of Health, at least 43,204 Palestinians have been murdered and at least 101,641 wounded in the Zionist regime's ongoing genocide in Gaza starting on October 7, 2023. Moreover, at least 11,000 people are unaccounted for, presumed dead under the rubble of their homes throughout the Gaza Strip. Palestinian and international organizations say that the majority of those murdered and wounded are women and children. The Zionist regime war has resulted in an acute famine, mostly in northern Gaza, resulting in the death of many Palestinians, mostly children. The Zionist regime aggression has also resulted in the forceful displacement of nearly 2 million people from all over the Gaza Strip, with the vast majority of the displaced forced into the densely crowded southern city of Rafah near the border with Egypt in what has become Palestine's largest mass exodus since 1948 Nakba. Later in the war, hundreds of thousands of Palestinians began moving from the south to central Gaza in a constant search for safety.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
On Tuesday, foreign ministers from 7 of the world's major economies gathered for a second day of talks in the historic town of Fuji, southeast of Rome. During the two-day summit, the ministers of Italy, US, Canada, UK, France, Germany and Japan discussed the situation in West Asia, Ukraine and in the Indo-Pacific as pressure to advance diplomatic efforts to resolve crisis in these regions is mounting. A group of pro-Palestine protesters staged a static demonstration in solidarity with the besieged Palestinians in the vicinity of the venue of the summit meeting. The G7 countries have provided political support for the Israeli regime and have significantly contributed to increasing insecurity and instability in West Asia, particularly through the U.S. military and financial support for Tel Aviv.
This is the G7 summit of genocide. All countries involved are Israel's major accomplices. Not only the US and the EU have unconditionally provided weapons to Netanyahu, but they have not done anything to stop the genocide. They have never condemned Israel for its atrocities. Furthermore, they are trying to delegitimize the International Criminal Court after arrest warrants against Netanyahu and Gallant were issued.
During the protest, international law experts explained that Italy must abide by the ICC's rulings, being one of the early signatories of the